Okay. So we're going to, this session really is a product of the meeting instructors have at the end of the week every year. We get together and talk about, you know, what we did this week and what we'd like to do, Lord willing, next year. And last year, one of the things Ken expressed to have an interest in doing at some point is doing a block on leadership in this class. And my recollection when he said that, I believe, and you can help me, I think in 2018, Joe Greer taught leadership here in first year. I was able to come back, and it maybe had been since we had talked about that. So he offered that up as something he'd like to have somebody to cover, and then that will kind of segue into why I'm standing up here. I had some interest in doing that, and what I'm about to tell you really matters nothing, matters not at all in the scheme of things. But some of you don't know me, don't know my background. I'll share that with you just to give you a little insight into why I have a kind of an enthusiasm and an interest in leadership generally. First 20 years of my professional life, I was in the United States Navy. I retired after 20 years, had opportunity to practice some leadership in organizations as large as 450 people and doing a lot of cool dynamic operations and things like that as an officer in the United States Navy. Following that, I spent 5 years in corporate America at a director level position, doing some executive stuff, team building, project management, that sort of thing. So all of that to say, that doesn't tell you I'm an expert, but I've got to practice some leadership some and been in situations where I was studying it in formal environments and trying to do that. But then most recently, I've had the privilege of serving as a shepherd at the church in Eastside in Bowling Green, Kentucky. So I'm doing some of that as well. And again, the grand scheme of things doesn't make me an expert, but let you know I've been thinking about the art and science of leadership for several years, and maybe there's a few things that can get us thinking about. And I want to talk about leadership generally, but always the emphasis from my perspective or the applications we can talk about primarily will be spiritual. And I hope you're down with that as well. So as we move through this, we'll talk about leadership pretty generally, but then my examples and my applications will likely be things that affect us in our homes, our families, in our local churches. But let me ask this. If somebody said, hey, I'm going to go to a Bible study on leadership, what book of the Bible would you guess you were going to study? Yeah, everybody would, because that great book, Hand Me Another Brick by Swindell, right? And it is a good book, and I've studied that a couple times. I really like that, and I think that's what Joe, we talked to Nehemiah when Joe Greer taught leadership here in 2018. But as I was contemplating what to do, I decided, well, I don't want to do that, because the last time we talked about a leadership here, it was from Nehemiah. And so not long afterwards, I was doing some reading with that lens on, with the idea of leadership lessons, and I was reading the book of Joshua. So that is where this came from. And this course we're going to call this week is Dare to Lead Like Joshua. And the first thing I always say when I start talking about leadership is don't tune out, no matter who you are. And there's always somebody in every crowd, maybe more than one somebody, sometimes like, well, that doesn't apply to me. I'm not a leader. And I would say at a minimum, think about maybe the worst you can think is I'm not a leader yet. And as soon as you add that yet to it, then you know it applies to you. But I'm going to suggest to you that it really applies to everyone. And when I sit down with young men and talk to them about becoming the leaders they need to be first in their homes is when they start thinking about it. But I'll go earlier than that, and I'd say, listen, Bob McPherson's first principle of leadership is first lead self. In other words, you can start practicing leadership with self-discipline and making yourself hold yourself to some standards. You're practicing leadership with those kind of things. So everybody starts and everybody has a way to begin using leadership principles even in their own lives. And leadership applies to everyone because there's lots of flavors to leadership. The one we most naturally think of is what you might call formal leadership or positional organizational leadership. This means that you're part of something that if they drew a wiring diagram, you'd be near the top and we'd all recognize you're a leader. So you can think corporate structure or a military chain of command, obviously. So we think about elders, in a sense, have organizational or formal leadership positions, as do fathers, as do husbands. That's kind of maybe the first place we go. But another form of leadership we talk about is informal leadership. And often we might, the best example of that is by example, because your example is leadership. Influence is leadership. And believe it or not, even in military studies of leadership, we study influence leadership, because often you find yourself in a staff position. where you're, it's not about whose boss has the most stars on his collar. It's about you and somebody else trying to get the right thing done for the greater organization. Neither one of you has clear linear authority over the other, but you need to work together. You need to be able to sell your idea. You need to influence others to get things done. So we work that way as well, and you already see how that works in your life. Everyone in here influences other people. And don't miss that point. If you have a little brother, a little sister at home, you influence other people, and influence is leadership. So even in a church setting, if you're not serving as an elder, you still have influence. As a faithful member of a local church, as the preacher particularly, maybe you have influence in a local church. And just as the example you are with your brothers and sisters in Christ as you spend time with them. So leadership lessons apply to everybody. Leadership lessons apply to people. Even if you are convinced right now, I haven't convinced you that you're a leader. You think, well, I'm just a follower. Well, leadership lessons apply to followers. Because so many people in our culture, in our context, are so unfamiliar with actual leadership that learning what it looks like is important for everybody. We're so unfamiliar with actual leadership, sometimes we reduce it, and sometimes you see this as people's expectations of elders, as Rick alluded to. Leadership is not just consensus taking or nose counting. I mean, you could train chimpanzees to do that, right? So that's not what leadership is, and there's a lot of people that are poor followers because they don't understand what leadership is. And maybe that will be a benefit of our time discussing it. Because you can learn to what to expect from leaders, what you should expect, what you have a right to expect from leaders is important, I think. And if nothing else, learning that will, at a minimum, make us all better followers. And I will tell you that, I can tell you, based, this is just me and anecdotal, but as I've seen other people progress through careers and different stage gates in life, somebody who never learns to be a good follower will never learn to be a good leader. That's something that is really missing in our culture now because everybody thinks from day one they should be in charge. And I will tell you this, and this is mostly as an elder because it didn't come up as much in my military career, but an axiom or a truism I've learned is those that know the most about leadership are those that have never actually practiced it. It's amazing that people that always know what we ought to be doing and never been in charge of nothing, right? So that this, think about that, and if there's any lesson you can learn from that, then that one's free. But the one other thing I want to say before we dive in here is I do want this to be a conversation. And that's why Ken let me have one of the afternoon blocks is because you look around the room, there are other people here that have a leadership experience in their life, men that have served or are serving as elders in churches. All of us have been followers at different places. And leadership, maybe as much as any other discipline that I've been exposed to or studied in life, you can learn lessons about what not to do from poor leaders and bad leadership, maybe as much as anything else. So even followers could have a lot to teach us as we talk about this. So I very much, occasionally I will pause. If I don't pause at the right time, throw your hand in the air and we will try to talk about these things as we think about daring to lead like Joshua or dare to be a leader. So open your Bibles to the book of Joshua. That's what we're going to work our way through the next 4 days. We're going to begin in the beginning. Let's just read with me Joshua chapter 1 and beginning in verse 1, Joshua's commission, Joshua's call to be a leader. Joshua 1 and verse 1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, just as I promised to Moses, from the wilderness and this Lebanon as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. And I think that's a passage that's pretty familiar to most of us as Bible students. But as you think about Joshua's commission, one point as we think about our future or our ability to lead is this something that comes out of verse 2 there, where God inspires Joshua. He says, now therefore arise. And I think that's where I want to start, because I think there's a dearth of leadership in our culture, in our country, in our society, and sometimes I think in our churches. And again, I think it's because we're a product of our society. And I think it's maybe for some other reasons we'll touch on in the 4 sessions we have for today. But let me say this to you. Leaders have to stand up. So you have to decide you want to grow in this ability. You don't just magically zone out into that waffle spot where you don't think about anything, and then somebody shake you and go, hey, why don't you be in charge? That's not how it works. So I would just suggest to you that we have to decide, I want to pursue some of the skills, the soft skills, the hard skills, the people skills, the requisite knowledge of His Word to become a leader in the church, if that's my goal, and it should be. But leaders have to stand up. You have to take some initiative. You have to have the willingness. You have to have the desire. Does that sound like one of the qualifications for elders? Do you hear that word desire show up there? You have to have a willingness to help. Now, let me just say this about that. That desire is not because I want to be in charge. The type of desire we're talking about here is the desire to use what skills you have, not to promote self, but to help others achieve and accomplish what they can achieve and accomplish. And then particularly in a spiritual setting, particularly as a leader in a church, your desire to lead is not so you can have a quarter office or get a big bonus. I can tell you that. Your desire is to be able to help lead that church into growing and becoming what God would have it to be. But you got to see the need and got to be willing to fulfill that need. You're going to have to step up. So God needs men to desire. God needs men to step up. God needs leaders to arise. And that's always been the case and will always continue to be the case. So then what I will say to you is I don't think that's always, there's always a lot of men everywhere that are willing to do that. Sometimes some that maybe shouldn't be willing to do that are willing to do that. But you guys tell me, what are the obstacles? What are the things that keep men from being willing to step out and say, I will start serving so I can grow into this position of being a leader? Fear? Fear of... Let's do fear of. I think you're right, but that'll help lead us in some directions, I think.
Resistance from the very outset.
And I think this is maybe something that's very unique about the model of leadership in the Lord's church is that the shepherds grow up out of the flock, right? And so if you have, particularly in an instance where maybe you grow up in the same church your whole life, and you're part of a flock who has a history of eating their own, how motivated are you to go up and be a shepherd one day? Right? Or you sit there and you realize, well, to be a shepherd of this bunch, they expect you just to do what they want. They expect you just to count noses and carry out their desires. So I think a lot of the hesitancy is fear of, and I'm going to go ahead and say it, sometimes we, the royal we, could be better Americans than we are Christians. Right, that kind of goes back to that 1950s idea that Stephen hit on this morning. And that shows up in churches. That shows up in Christians' attitudes about being led. And so when you imagine if that's the environment our future leaders are coming up in, then that would be a hesitancy for someone to be willing to put themselves out there. So I think that is a real issue. Any other thoughts or... Yes, sir. And I'll tell you, that is a big one. And the men that are nodding their head most, I will tell you, and you guys tell me if I'm wrong, you thought about that before you accepted it, but now it's all you think about it. Somebody's got to do it. It's God's plan for the organization of the church to have leadership. And because it's hard, there's no reason to not do it. And that one hits because I thought about that, and that was the reason I said no the first time I was asked. And then now that I've had, and I'm in the position of serving like that, I haven't quit thinking about that. The level of responsibility that you have shepherding the souls of your brothers and sisters. But God needs men to stand in the gap. God needs men that will step up, men that will rise up. And you can't wait till you're 50 to decide you're willing to do that, men. So that starts now. It starts, if you're not married yet, it starts with choosing who you're going to marry. If you are married, it starts with having long talks about your and your wife's responsibilities toward the local church. And then it starts with how you raise your children and how early in life you start impressing those things upon them. Let's knock out a couple more, then we'll move on. That's right. That's right. And I would suggest to you, though, the greater failure than that is a local church that is not organized according to the way God said it should be organized. So those are things that grown men weigh when they make decisions. And you got to decide, am I going to let my personal fear of doing the right thing keep me from doing the right thing? And so those are all things to be considered, to be thought about. But in the end of the day, Joshua wasn't signing up for summer camp, was he? He knew what was going to happen, and God said, I need leadership, Joshua. Joshua, now, therefore, arise. So having said that, from that lens of what leadership looks like, let's just go straight to the job description. And again, because I know you're good Bible students, you know that from Joshua chapter 1, I'm going to tell you the job description is to be strong and be courageous. And if you read through chapter 1, you're going to see that phrase appears four times. And three times here just in the first few verses. Let's read verses 6 through 9 together. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you, be strong and courageous, do not be frightened, and do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. So, to begin with, the first job of a leader is to be strong and courageous. And again, in the context of Joshua, we understand that's leading a nation at war into an invasion of a foreign land. Even though he has God with him, and that's what God has assured him of here, it's going to cost Joshua something. God is going to need Joshua to be strong and courageous and to lead the people in that way. And we've already talked about some of the reasons why that requirement is still there for leaders. You have to take unpopular positions sometimes. You have to make unpopular announcements sometimes. One of the men I serve with said, you know, I've decided the job description for elder is a never-ending series of uncomfortable conversations. And there's a lot to that, right? You have to sit down and talk to folks about things you wish it was somebody else's job sometimes. But you have to be strong and courageous. And so there's that on the individual level as you work with brethren through their problems, as you steer, as you think and plan for the work, the growth of a congregation, as you contemplate what is being taught both locally and pay attention to what's going on and a little broader out there so that you got to inoculate your flock from false teaching and movements and things that are happening that you know will influence them. And sometimes they don't get there as soon as you do. Sometimes you seem like an alarmist because you're warning about things they haven't sniffed yet and that sort of thing. So a lot of times you have to be strong and courageous in whatever you're dealing with. And it's got to be, we have to be willing to be that way about everything, just like Joshua was. But it may surprise you to find out that, you know, God expects that from the people too. If you flip over real quickly, come back, we'll come back to chapter 1. But over in chapter 10, verse 25, this is following the victory over the five kings. But in Joshua 10, 25, says, and Joshua said to them, do not be afraid. Joshua said to them, do not be afraid or dismayed. Be strong and courageous, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies against whom you fight. So right there you see the idea of trickle down. God expects the people to be strong and courageous, but He first requires that of leadership. And here's the principle. Followers will not be strong and courageous if their leadership is not strong and courageous. That's a lesson I think we learned here from Joshua. But there's purpose for that. It's not just to flex or to show off your own individual personal courage. It's because of the impact that has. It's in order to accomplish something. And here in our text, it's in order to cause the people, verse 6 tells us. And the idea there is in some things we've already hit on. Be strong and courageous, and then use that to influence. Use that to cause the people to do what's right. Use that to cause the people to be built up in their strength and their courage to serve God and to do things God's way. Be strong and courageous to live your life the way it needs to be. So if nothing else, even if you're not saying it, you're doing it. And your example shows people it can be done. Your example shows people, no, your kids will survive if they don't have a phone when they're four. Your example shows, no, look, my kids didn't go to prom and they turned out okay. There are things you can do just by your example that will help others take the courage to do the right thing, make the hard choice when they come to that crossroad in life, when they come to that decision point. And then really, he calls the people, it's about creating vision. And we won't go into this a lot. In my mind, the difference between a manager and a leader is here. A manager can take care of execution, but it takes leadership to help create vision and then help create buy-in, help to get people to support that vision, to try to be able to communicate. And communication is a lot of this, but to help a group of people see, hey, this is where we are. This is where God wants us to be. Here's a plan to get there. And let's get on board and let's try to do that. But you have to be confident in that. It has to be well thought out. But you have to have the courage to kind of point the way. And that's really what I think what leadership does. And as you look, you know, that's in verse 6. If you look at verses 7 and 8 now through there, what do you cause the people to do? And now particularly as a spiritual leader, cause the people to do the things listed there when you're talking about leading a group of God's people. Cause them to be careful to do all that's in the law, to not turn from the law, to speak where the law speaks, to think on it, and to be careful and to do all that is written. So in the context there, that's what God was saying, Joshua, your job will be is to, look, do what's in the law. Keep covenant with me. And fundamentally now as leaders in local churches, that's where we want to point people. That's ultimately our vision is God's vision, and we're trying to have the courage and the strength to lead other people to dedicate to looking at the Word of God in the same way God here tells Joshua to look at the law of Moses, to have that level of dedication and devotion to it. So that, as verse 8, I think it is, ends there, then the payoff is, for then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. And then cause the people to remember that God is with you. When times get hard, when you have challenges, you want people to remember we're doing God's work here. And as long as we're doing the right thing and God is on our side, we're on the right side. And we're on the winning side. And that's what one of the things that Joshua was told to remember there in verse 9, that God is with you. So as you think about those things as a leader, you have to be strong and courageous first, personally, to sign up for it. Be willing to step out there. And then so that you're in a position to help others to grow in that same direction when it comes to serving the Lord and that dedication to His law, His ways that Joshua was told there. But don't get caught up in your own strength and your own courage. Remember, God is with you and you count and rely on Him. And that's, strong leadership is maybe off-putting to some people, again, because they don't see it exercised or they're Americans more than they're Christians. They're not used to being led. They don't want to follow. Those sort of things. But be strong, be courageous, and when you're in a position of leadership, do that. And here's a little surprise, I think, that comes out of chapter 1 is because, you know what? Your devoted followers want you to. The followers that are devoted to the things God's calling Joshua here to be devoted to, they want you to be strong and courageous. If you kept reading in chapter 1, verses 12 through 15, you'd have Joshua coming to the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and reminding them what Moses had said to them. Yes, God's given you that land on the other side of the Jordan, but remember, when it comes time for us to cross, you got to go with us. And no rest for you till your brothers have rest. And so he's called them back and brought them in to remember of what Moses had told them. And read their answer with me, beginning in verse 16. And they answered Joshua, all that you have commanded us, we will do. And wherever you send us, we will go. That's a little Ruthian almost, isn't it? Doesn't that fire you up? So I'm a visualizer. So when I think about these hard warriors standing there, and Joshua coming up and says, hey, you guys, you got to cross the river with us, go take care. He goes, oh, you point the way, Joshua, we're with you. All that you say, we will do. Wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your commandment and disobeys your word, whatever you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. Now I don't want to get too carried away there. We don't want to make a literal application of that. But you do see that these men were willing to follow, and they wanted Joshua. Devoted followers want leaders to do what God wants them to do. Devoted followers want leaders to be strong and courageous. And while we'll make this application, even when with dealing with dividers. Because you see, the last thing they said is, hey, if somebody won't listen to you, Joshua, we'll deal with them with the sword. And I want to suggest to you that even in local churches, maybe one of the places where it gets hardest to deal with is in matters of church discipline, or when you have people that have a divisive spirit, or a bad attitude, or a false teaching emerges, or people are undermining the unity of a group. The devoted followers want the leadership to stand up, to have the strength and the courage to address it, and to maintain unity of the spirit and the bond of peace in that local church. And I think that is a good, maybe a surprising little lesson that pops up there at the end of chapter 1. So what's the job description for a leader? Be strong and courageous in all the ways we talked about there. Any questions, comments, thoughts on what we've seen so far in chapter 1? When is it hardest, you think, now for an elders in a church? What type of situations, even just generally, you think it's hardest for them to stand up and be matters of opinion? Their family or just family generally? Yeah. Yeah. Were you? Absolutely. So that's part of that process of deciding early in teaching your children while they're under your feet that you love them, but you love the Lord more. And they already know where you stand on your devotion to the law, and that if they grow up and think you're going to choose them over your devotion to God, then they've missed something along the way. That's easy. You may say it's easier said than done. We'll get to doing it, though. Start as early and as often as you can while your children are small and convincing yourself of that. Because the time to prepare to do hard things is not when you get there. You got to be thinking about things while it's still objective, before it becomes emotional. I think it's a leadership thing. For instance, right now, as an eldership at Eastside, we haven't had this situation, but we've already got together and talked about what the Bible teaches about divorce and the cause of divorce and what the Greek word porneia means, and that pornography use is not a scriptural cause for divorce. And we wanted to go ahead and talk about that and figure that out and be sure about that before we had a sympathetic young lady sitting across the table from us and in a bad situation where we or other people in the church would feel bad for the situation they were in. So before it becomes an emotional thing, you're thinking ahead, you're planning ahead, you're making those decisions and trying to, you know, be proactive in that way. But because we probably all can think of instances where leadership hasn't shown the strength and courage it should when those hard moments occur. Any other thoughts, questions, or yes, sir?
This is a reflection on the fear of being responsible for souls as an elder. It's always amazed me that if God gives you children, you're already in that position. You're responsible for eternal souls. And that is our prep work for becoming an elder, is taking that spiritual responsibility as fathers seriously.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, Brent. I think if you think about that in God's wisdom, His design for the home, all things being equal, that if a devoted Christian becomes a husband, then becomes a father, in a few years he would be qualified to be an elder, wouldn't he? All things being equal, because of the way he lived as a husband, the way he lived as a father, the way he trained his children, in his own growth as a disciple and a brother. But you're right, we already have that responsibility if we have children. So as we think about the job description, then it gets very practical, I think, beginning in verse 10, and you get down to just what do leaders do? And I think there's a good little list that emerges here from this instance. And again, some of these will shock people because they don't like the language. But I'm just going to quote from Joshua here because, again, leadership is, I think, a little understood in our culture. And a lot of the times it's because it's so little practiced. Because it's easier to sit back and be a manager, make decisions about repaving the parking lot or saving enough money for a new roof. That's easy. And there are elderships that will default to that position because that's easy. And we just, you know, we want to think beyond that. But real leadership does shock some people. But notice, beginning of verse 10, that among the things leaders do is leaders command. Verse 10 says, "And Joshua commanded the officers of the people." And that's not a very long sentence there, but that's enough to say that's what leaders do. Joshua is given charge, and so he takes out, and he has some authority because of the position he has. And as we make the analogy, elders have the authority of the position that they have to shepherd. I think it's silly. Let me put it this way. We have the metaphor of the shepherd and the sheep for a reason. And there'll be those that argue that elders have no authority except their example. Okay, now, do you really think that's how it works with a flock of sheep and a shepherd? If you drive by and see a flock of sheep and a tall thing with a stick, who do you think's in charge of that movement over there? Is there any question? There's no. So the metaphor, unless you just want it not to make sense, the metaphor, I think, it inherently shows authority in the way that that's presented to us. But leaders command, but you also see in verse 11, they delegate, right? So Joshua said what he said in verse 10, then here's what he told them to do. Give them instruction. Pass through the midst of the camp and command the people. So he said, now you guys go, I'm commanding you, you go command others, and talks about making preparation for the movement they're going to make for the land they're going to possess. So good leaders command, better leaders command and delegate. You get help with the work that needs to be done. Moses did that with the judges to help him with the ruling among the people. And both of those, maybe the first one particularly gets some pushback, but command is part of the job. Sometimes you have to make hard decisions. Sometimes in areas of judgment, particularly, the elders have to make a decision, provide the direction, or give guidance. And quite frankly, with accountability goes responsibility, right? So elders, as we already talked with, have the accountability, know that we watch over folks' souls, and we have a responsibility. We have the accountability for doing that. It just follows that we have some responsibility in the guidance to help with the leadership of those folks for whom we will answer. But delegation is, I think there's an important thing to think about here that some of us struggle with, is that's the finding that fine line between micromanagement and attention to detail. You know, I worked for a guy in the Navy who used to say, "Mac, listen, one man's micromanagement is another man's attention to detail," which is his way of saying, "Bob, prepare to be micromanaged." But anyway, if you're going to delegate, it means you have to learn to trust some people. That's inherent in a willingness to delegate. And if you're one of those people that thinks your leaders ought to be delegating more, then what you can do is work on showing them you're trustworthy. Do the things that you can do in a way they can see that you can do what you can do, and they'll be willing to ask you to do the next thing. So that trust works both ways. Very often people say, "Well, you guys don't trust us." And the answer is, "Well, why should we trust you?" Because we have overlap, goodness happens, right? So leaders have to be willing to trust, and people have to make themselves trustworthy. Demonstrate the ability to serve. You notice that one of the qualifications of a deacon is to kind of first prove themselves and then serve as a deacon. And I think that's a good way to think about it. Do you have a hand up? Yes. That's right. Trust is, I think, inherent and reflective of having a relationship. You also notice leaders have to communicate. So then look at verse 11 again. All the components that Rick talked about. Joshua is very clear. Here, you go, you tell the people, this is what you tell the people, here's the instructions. So they knew exactly what to go out and communicate to the people. And I will tell you, and other elders in the room, that's one of the hardest things, isn't it? Other husbands in the room, everybody in the room, communication's hard, right? But communication is the lifeblood of leadership. Whether it's simply the ability to clearly communicate vision, or just to make sure the simplest task gets done the way that you want it to be done, you have to communicate. I thought of, during one of your examples, When you start up an aircraft, we use what's called challenge, reply, reply. That way, you pitch, the other guy catches and tells you he caught, and you look over and say, yes, I saw you caught. So that's how you, when you do a check, it's like, hey, turn the right generator on. He says, he clicks the button and goes, right generator on. I'll look over at the right generator button and see that it's on, in the on position. So that's how you know you had communication. You get it out there, get feedback, and make sure you were understood. But communicate is very important in the job of a leader. Clear instructions, because we have to ask people to do difficult things. And sometimes there has to be a level of detail there that people need to understand. Listen, communication is hard. And probably the places where we spend more time going back and saying, yep, sorry, we could have been clearer about that, as much as anything, as a group of elders. Because, first of all, we got a lot of bad catchers in the world. How to say that? We actually have times where somebody will say, hey, what time is that? We're like, well, we only posted on the website, sent an email, two texts, and made a Facebook event, but I'll send up a smoke signal if you need me to. You're like, we've communicated this every way you possibly can, but okay, sorry, no, it starts at 7. Hope you can make it. You know, that, so that happens sometimes. People don't do a good job communicating, but we know that. And when you decide to be a leader, you have to account for that, and you have to be willing to communicate. You have to be willing to over-communicate if that's what it requires to make sure people know what they need to know. And then the last one here, then we'll take a little quick break, is leaders hold accountable. So if you go back and you look at 12 through 15 again, just catch the word when Joshua approached that group of warriors from the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, what did he start his speech with? Remember, he comes to hold them accountable. You remember what Moses said to you. And so he has expectations that they will do what they said they would do. And I think that's something... We try to communicate this when people meet with us because they want to become a member at Eastside, is that they can have expectations of us, but we also have expectations of them. And they don't know that unless you tell them. They don't know that unless you communicate it to them. But then we also talk about the accountability measures we have in place. Hey, we take attendance, not because we think perfect attendance gets you into heaven, but because we want to know if you're struggling. That might be a symptom. So we have some things in place that you can count on us to do these things. Here's what we would like to be able to count on you to do, to be part of the work here and to help this local church function like it should. But leaders have to hold accountable. If you don't have accountability, you don't have any leadership. If you don't have any accountability, you don't have any expectations. And if there are no expectations, people will live up to them. Did you catch that? If there are zero expectations, everybody will live up to them. You can absolutely guarantee that. Any questions or comments here before I'll give you a break to the hour because I've got a little extra time. Any questions, comments, thoughts so far? Yes, sir.
Yes. What is your definition or explanation difference between accountability and responsibility?
Okay, so accountability means that I'm going to answer for it. And so if I'm going to answer for it, then I need to be given the responsibility to make sure it can happen. So if I'm going to answer for your performance, then I need to have the ability to direct you to some extent and to say, well, this is what you need to do, Mark. Mark, listen, I'm going to be held responsible for Mark. So, Mark, I need you to be willing to take this guidance from me. Does that make sense? If I have the accountability, you need to have the requisite authority, you might say. If you work at a job and the boss is going to hold you responsible for what time the truck got loaded and left, but the guys at the loading dock didn't work for you, you'd say, hey, boss, there's a misalignment here between my accountability and my responsibility. You'd want that fixed, right? So that's the responsibility. If I'm going to answer for it, then inherent in that is the authority to help direct it or guide it or make sure it gets done or help get it done. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. It's about matching what I'm responsible for with my authority to get it done.
It's almost reversed in some school settings.
Really?
Sadly.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've seen places where you were held responsible for something you had no way to have any influence of where it happened or not. But that was wrong. Yeah.
That's why I asked what.
Yeah. Any other thoughts, questions, comments? You guys, okay. Let's take a break. Just top of the hour, we'll pick back up about 5 minutes. Yeah. Right.
Would you prove it?
From chapter 2, and again. This is only because I think because I was reading Joshua through the lens of, hey, what leadership lessons do you see here, and what can we extract from that? But from chapter 2, right away, you get the reminder that good leaders always are making assessment. A good leader takes a look around. And you have that demonstrated here in chapter 2 is little reconnaissance, right? Joshua sending spies into the land they're about to take. And so this, from the context of leadership, it's knowing what's going on, thinking before you act, looking around before you act. This is where good leaders, and we'll go to our context, and this is something similar to what Rick mentioned, good leaders ask for input. Good leaders have their hand on the pulse of the congregation. They want to know what the sheep are thinking about certain things. They run things by them to see what level of support there are for matters of judgment, those kind of things. Good leaders do that. I will tell you, it's a little known secret, but even good military leaders do that. They call in key staff members and they get good input and they get all the information they can before they make decisions. Now, when they get all the information and they make the decision, they slap the table and that's everybody's decision. Boy, I miss those days when it was everybody's decision that when the leader decided. But good leaders do that. They look around. They think before they act. They consult stakeholders because now that doesn't mean I'm saying we're consensus takers because as Rick pointed out, we may have to do the right thing instead of the popular thing. But good leaders will seek that input. Luke used a term that is I wouldn't use the exact term, but this is the same idea that I think is good. He called it leadership capital, and we talk about that in relationships sometimes. There was a book, a marriage book. Stephen's not here. One of those marriage books that talked about putting money in the love bank, that sort of thing, so you could leverage that later. Yeah. Well, leadership is a trust game. So you know, you show your concern for people, you give them reasons to trust you because you've asked them, you've got their input, they know you're concerned. Even if you don't do what they want you to do, at least they know you're concerned about them. You care what they think, care what they feel, and the more they trust you, then the more they'll follow you. It's not a game. I don't mean to sound like it's a game or a trick, but that's just what good leaders do. They build trust because they're generally concerned about coming to the best solution and are willing to listen to other voices. You don't abdicate your responsibility, but you take a look around. You make assessment. Joshua sends out spies here, but it's about knowing what's going on in your church with the people. And anything else like that helps you in your decision-making. There's a little tangent here that maybe doesn't apply directly. We'll move kind of quickly. But you think about this. In a local congregation context, what if people heard? So you have Rahab here, and you know, well, let's read starting in verse 8. You know that the spies went in. You know the king found out there were some spies. You know Rahab hid them. And then here's what she said to them, beginning of verse 8. Before the men lay down, she came up to the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and the fear of all has fallen upon you, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and to Og, who you devoted to destruction. All that to say this is, I thought about that. There's some applicability to us. There's this idea of, you know, as you're thinking about being the leader, your family has a reputation. Elders, your church has a reputation. What if people heard? So you're managing to some extent. You're managing that sort of thing. What do people know about the group you're at? Is that a sound church? Do they love each other? Is there a history of division and infighting at that place? So there's something to think about that, I think. Making an assessment and then think about your church's reputation. I think that kind of thing will be applicable to, are you, you know, you new Christians moving to the area. Why would they choose to come where you are? Why would they choose to worship with the church that you're a part of? And then it really backs into, I think, maybe our effectiveness in evangelism. You know, what do people know about that building on the corner of that street in your town and the people that go there? You know, that would have some impact on their willingness to listen to somebody from there who wanted to talk to them about the gospel. So maybe a little more of a stretch here as a lesson, but I think it's something that has to be thought about. Maybe the particular influence it could have on evangelism. Because if you think about how the story plays out with Rahab here, just a couple little applications because she said, hey, this is what we've heard. And you know how she and her family responded to what they heard and how that worked out as the Bible story progresses. But when some hear, they will want to respond. Some want to be saved. And then I would say from the language of the spies here and with Rahab, deal kindly and fairly with them. And all that to say this, all those things really influence or we're talking about thinking about what the reputation of the organization you're leading is. What will people think about it when they hear about it? How do you treat people? What are you known for? And that kind of thing. So there's something to that. But leaders don't go off half-cocked. Leaders think before they act. They're always making an assessment. I don't suggest getting spies, literally, but do the recon. Know what's going on the ground. There's a great book out called They Smell Like Sheep. It's about the idea of shepherds have to be down with the sheep and know what's going on, know their people, that sort of thing. And I think that plays out here, and that's the point I chose to make with that part of the story. Any thoughts on any of that? You ever known of or been victim of a local church having a bad reputation? People, here's what we've heard about you. I don't know if anyone wants to tell stories or not. I just want to make a point. That's a real thing. And we're not doing brand management here, but in a sense we are. We want it to be the truth, but you have to think about what we do. We don't do it to build a reputation. But what we do, people will figure out, people will see, people will notice, and you'll end up doing that in the long run. So leaders think about those things as well. And then mainly, or something that really comes to play maybe from the book of Joshua is how often leaders simply have to move out on faith. And if you get over to chapter 3 now, and you know we're talking about them crossing the Jordan, and just the simple thing that Joshua says here, you have not passed this way before. Turn with me to chapter 3 of Joshua. Then Joshua rose up early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim, and they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, as soon as you see the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priest, then you shall set up from your place and follow it. Yet there will be a distance between you and it of 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. So that language just reminds those people of their need for leadership moving forward. And in a sense, that's constant, right? Because what's today's date? What is it? Okay, so as of tomorrow, nobody will have ever been on July 9th before, right? So there's a sense in when leadership always is taking people into places we haven't been before. Things that will happen we hadn't thought about. Any of the elders here ever been surprised by anything? There's always things that are going to happen that you have to say, hey, we've not been this way before. And there are going to be leadership in unprecedented times is extremely difficult. I wasn't. Were any of you men serving during COVID? How many guys are in congregations that have elders during COVID? Were there some unprecedented times there where men being put in places to make hard decisions? So this is why leadership, because we're always going to end up in places we haven't been before. So if nothing else, this underscores, I think, one of the needs for leadership. And I don't know, maybe we have extra time at the end, we can talk about some COVID stories. But that was difficult. But I tell you what, you saw it exposed some weakness in leadership in congregations and followership in congregations because hard decisions had to be made and there wasn't a lot of grace and there wasn't a lot of patience in a lot of instances and things that came to bear. And I will say something else that came to the surface during that was there were a lot of people who decided they were Americans first and Christians second. That I had a guy on the phone one time, he called and he asked me a question about, are y'all requiring masks there at the east side? I said, well, let me go ahead and answer it this way. The elders have asked us, because of some members here that have some very serious health conditions and are very concerned, if we would be willing to wear masks, because those brethren have said they would be willing to assemble with us if we would all be willing to wear masks. I said, so yes, we have been wearing masks. He said, well, I think that violates my constitutional right. And I paused a minute because I do that sometimes. I paused for a minute and I said, well, you know, we have another document here we're working off of. And they didn't end up visiting it, he said. But the point being, a lot of those things, the ability to stay together in difficult times was based on the leadership that existed there before that challenge popped up. The level of trust that had been created between the flock and the shepherds, and the realization that those men were leading in difficult, unprecedented times, that we had never passed that way before, and a level of trust that allowed people to follow, even in a period of conflicting information, a lot of different opinions about things. So anyway, you guys lived through that, so you know how difficult that was. But if nothing else from the story of Joshua, that episode there just reminds us of the constant need for leadership because of changing times and emerging challenges. But I want you to see that if you want to, leadership is what helps people get ready for these emerging challenges and things that you may not even see. And that comes out in this little episode here. The guidance to the group here is, hey, consecrate yourself. And it's about getting ready. That's exactly, I think, what that idea is. The idea of consecration carries with it the instruction to both be holy and be ready. Hey, you be holy and be ready to prove yourself set apart. Get yourself ready and then be willing to follow that arc wherever it goes. It's going to go across a river where the water's going to quit flowing, which is pretty natural, right? So, but these people are being told, hey, get ready, consecrate yourself, prove yourself to be set apart. And really, leadership is about helping people get right and get ready for whatever life throws at them, to strengthen their faith and their ability to withstand, to persevere and withstand whatever we have to in this life. Getting people ready involves bringing them near to listen. Look at verse 9. And Joshua said to the people, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. So one aspect of leadership, again, particularly, fathers, in your homes, with your children, come near and listen. Reading of Scripture, teaching them those things, train them those ways in your home, right? That happens there. Also in the church setting, the idea of teaching people how to be holy and how to be ready. This leads to the areas in leadership in a local church, that your teaching program. What are you doing to feed the flock? Leaders have to be sure they're calling people in to come and listen and to get them prepared to deal with the difficulties of life. And again, we do that again also as fathers and as husbands. And they're going to cause the people to remember what God has done. Look at verse 4. I'm sorry, chapter 4 and verse 6. And you guys know this story about after, as they were about to complete the river crossing, and Joshua had them get the stones up to create the memorial, right? And as he explains that to them somewhat, beginning there in verse 6, that this may be a sign among you, when your children ask in time to come, what do these stones mean to you? Then you will tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord when it passed over the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever. And I want you to think how much of the job of spiritual leadership is consistent, regular reminding each other of what God has done for us. Right? We do that, you think immediately of the Lord's Supper. But how much of our teaching and our preaching is remember that our whole life is a response to His grace. And his mercy and the blessings that He's shown us, the love He's shown the whole world, we talked about in our first lesson this morning. But that's what spiritual leaders do. Bring those people near to listen. That, you know, whatever you're doing to teach, we've talked about the utility of gospel meetings already came up one time. Whatever you're doing, bring people near to listen so they hear that, so they're reminded what God has done for them. And then in addition to that, leaders also make just the practical preparations, right? Because that has to be done. Down in verses 12 and 13, really what you find out, the sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, and half-tribe of Manasseh passed over armed before the people of Israel as Moses had told them. So just think about this, very practical. Hey, I've got these 2.5 tribes worth of fighting men who aren't burdened with their wives and kids right now. Let me put them in front, right? Let me let them be the advance guard. Let them cross the river first. And so you have this a very practical sound military decision here that Joshua is making or executing here, even if that's the deal they had cut with Moses. So leaders, we do these things simultaneously. We're continually cultivating a culture in our churches where our job is to bring together the people to listen, to help them always be remembering why we're doing what we're doing, what God has done for us, and in the midst of that, doing all the practical things we can to execute, facilitate that, to make that work out. This idea of making practical preparations while also thinking about and always never quitting thinking about your loftier motivations and your spiritual goals, it also reminded me of that one episode in Nehemiah, this mixture of trusting God, but also making the practical preparations. You remember in chapter 4, verse 9, where it talks about the threat and Nehemiah's responses. It says, and they prayed, you remember the second part of that verse? And set a guard. So they prayed, and then they put the armed guards out, right? He did both. He's trusted in God, continuing worried about that spiritual development, also taking the practical measures they can take to ensure success, because so often we're moving out on faith. That's what God's called us to do, right? So He's our motivation. Our response, our allegiance to Him for what He's done for us is our motivation. That's our higher calling. Leaders in local churches are continually reminding people of that through our preaching, through our teaching, through our devotion to being organized and doing the work the way He's told us to do that, knocking out those practical things in a way He's told us to do that, always realizing we're moving out on faith. And I like there's kind of a result statement here at the end of chapter 4. It's not so that people can say, look what good leadership they have there. It's all the glory goes to God. And ultimately, if they did these things the way Joshua had lined them out, in verse 24 it says, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So that's the payoff. That's what leaders hope to accomplish, that God is glorified. That if you can help people to live lives, that people on the outside look and say, they're godly. They're serving God. They're not doing that for themselves. They're not doing that because of their own strength, their own ability. That you could cause God to be glorified, whether that's by your family, husbands, your family, fathers, the churches you're members of, what part can you play in helping that be what's going on there? Or then particularly if you matriculate to a leadership position, if you end up being an elder in a local church, that's what it's all about, is that God is glorified as you lead that group of His people moving out on faith, trusting Him all along the way, always reminding people that's why you're doing what you're doing, and even let that guide you as you make the practical decisions. So, chapters 3 and 4, it's about leading in unprecedented times, and tomorrow's unprecedented. It's about having groups of people as ready, as right and ready as they can be to respond the way godly people need to respond to whatever tomorrow holds. Any questions, comments, stories, wisecracks?
I saw an interview one time of Navy SEAL, and they were interviewing us, and finally they asked questions. If Navy SEALs are known for having extensive plans, they've got everything planned out. He says, so what do you do when it doesn't go as planned? The SEAL says, it never goes like we planned. That's
yeah. That's right.
I
got some stories that verify everything you said that are kind of interesting. Involve Somali pirates. But, you know, you guys, the sports analogy I get all the time is, oh, because you know what? You guys have heard this. You got to practice like you play. Why? Because you play like you practice. In the military, we say you got to train like you're going to fight, so you fight like you train. You know, that. So those things, and this is the idea of don't wait till crisis to start building up the faith of your followers. Don't wait till the crisis is right here. You bring it, come and listen. Remember what God has done for us. You're building that leadership capital. You're making people that are devoted servants of God, so when that moment of crisis comes, they already know what side they're on. They're already leaning in the right direction. They're already prone to make the right decision, to do the thing that will make God happy, to actually be ready to move out on faith. Because listen, if in a difficult situation, if the right answer is easy, everybody will do it. Right? So leadership is getting people ready to do the hard things. It's in a conversation over lunch. And, you know, it's made me sound old. So when I finish, I'll yell at you to get off my lawn, probably. But, you know, you've all grew up hearing preachers talk about, you know, before I die, we may actually see actual persecution in this country. And you go, well, that's probably not going to happen. I think we all get a little closer to thinking that's a reality all the time. Well, when's the time to start getting the people younger than you in your church ready to face real persecution? Is it when the government's knocking on the door? Or is it yesterday? Yeah. So that's the value of vision. That's the value of leadership. It's helping be thoughtful about the times you're bringing the people together to come and listen. You're bringing the people together to remember who they serve, remember what God has done for them, and then you're making those very practical preparations to help you withstand the evil of that day. And then the last thing we'll look at today, and then we can open it up for Q&A, is preparing for success from chapter 5. Because here's the thing, it doesn't just happen, right? You won't wake up one day and accidentally be qualified to be an elder. You know, you won't just wake up one day and have married the right person, got some thought into it. You won't just wake up one day and the kids turned out great if you didn't think about it until it was time for them to leave the house. Nothing really happens by accident. So if you want to have that good success, remember there in chapter 1, after listing Joshua, here's your commitment to the law of the Lord. Here's what your commitment needs to be to the law that God gave Moses. And then at the very end of verse 8, it says, then you will find success wherever you go. You have to prepare for success. And it has some unique challenges to it as well. And one of the first ones leaders have to do to prepare a group to succeed may be overcoming some inertia. Inertia may be the most powerful force in human dynamics. And the way we usually see that is people not in motion tend to remain not in motion. Right, that's the inertia that we usually are fighting against. But it's amazing how powerful inertia is among human beings. But let's talk about this a little bit. Look at these lessons from Joshua's leadership decisions here. So in chapter 5, we'll just pick up the reading with me in verse 2. So this is after, you guys know the story. This is after you've stopped, God has stopped the flood-swollen river for you so you can take your army into enemy territory. You with me? Visualize. And then that river closes again, and then it dawns on you, oh wait, I'm in enemy territory with no line of retreat now because the river is flood swollen. And now Joshua says, and now what I'm going to do is take all my warriors and incapacitate you for a few days. Right? So you talk about moving out on faith. But so look what happens here beginning of verse 2. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeth Haraloth. And you guys could keep reading. And the reason is because they had not, the second generation that had come out of Egypt, had come of age after they left Egypt, had not been circumcised. So that's overcoming inertia, right? And leaders have to be willing to examine and sometimes even change practices. Examine and correct. So there was this inertia. They hadn't been doing the right thing, but they hadn't been doing it for a while. But when a leader discovers we haven't been doing the right thing, what will spiritual leadership do? Let's do the right thing. Is that a challenge sometimes? Have you ever heard anybody say, but we've never done this before? You ever heard that? Or it's first cousin, we used to always do it like this. You know, both of those are the same thing. There's that human inertia that sometimes has to be overcome. And that's what you see Joshua doing here with, and again, don't miss the circumstances. That's a big ask. I can just imagine when Joshua comes out and explains to him, here's what we're going to do. Somebody will say, hey, Josh, can I talk to you for a second? I mean, you realize that we just crossed a river and it's flooded. We got no line of retreat. And it's just us camped with our back to the river in this entire enemy territory here, completely surrounded by these foreign armies. And we're going to circumcise all of our warriors and everybody into bed for 3 or 4 days, right? That's what we're doing here. So absolutely, Joshua was moving out on faith and calling them to do that. But also, he's reversing a practice that the people had got accustomed to. Or he's having them do something they hadn't been doing. I think there's a lot of deep meaning here. There's being shown that if you're going to be a covenant people with God, I just thought of a terrible pun. I'll just use this a little bit. You got to have skin in the game. That's a terrible pun, right? But yeah, the bigger point of this is he's taking them back to the most fundamental symbol of that covenant, right? If you're going to be God's covenant people, we got to get this right. You got to go back to that very thing that makes you different than people around you. So there's a very, I think, very deep spiritual meaning here is if you're going to accept God's deliverance across the Jordan, you're going to show your faith and be part of this covenant as well. So I think it's a very powerful, very important idea, but it was a leader reversing negative inertia there, getting them to start doing something that they hadn't been doing. And that example, I think, is important. Elders have to be willing to do that. I think particularly leaders have to be willing to do that. Hey, listen, maybe more so than a local church, in your family. Right now, you're the only one who knows this question. Is your family, are your habits the best they can be? Do you and your family read the Bible as much at home as you should? Do you have as much family Bible study time as you should? Do you watch too much television as a family? Do you eat too many meals apart? Should you make an effort to get together more and eat around the table together? There are little things in your personal life right now where you have bad inertia. Do you have opportunities right now to do some of this, to fix this, to go home on Friday night and kiss your wife and say, honey, I'm sorry, we're going to do something better as a family going forward. You can do this kind of stuff in the places where God has made you a leader now. If you're sitting here and you're single, you have bad inertia in your life somewhere. There's some habits you have that you could break. Maybe you have a porn addiction. Statistics show us that somewhere in the room there'll be 1.5 to 3 guys in here that have a porn problem. You know what? You can decide right now, first lead self in my life, I'm going to stop this inertia. I'm going to fix this. I'm going to overcome this thing I haven't been doing right in the past. So these kind of things, anyone, any spiritual person, any time in their life, need to be willing to do this. To examine and change when I need to examine and change. The difference is for leaders, sometimes you need to do it for others. You need to help lead others in doing that difficult process of examining and changing. You know, things change. You get a lot of opportunities if you move. Like, I grew up in rural Kentucky. And when one of the blessings, I think, for me was joining the Navy, going all around the world or even all around our country. And when I first Sunday morning, I assembled with saints in Southern California, I saw some things I'd never seen before. And so I had, as a young man, that fight or flight thing kind of kicks in, but it forced me to start thinking, okay, Bob, now is your response because you've just never done it that way or because it's actually right or wrong? And it forces you to start thinking like that. But to the extent you find that things are right or wrong, leadership has to be willing to re-examine, willing to overcome inertia, either to get a group of people to start doing something they haven't been doing or to change something they have been doing. And that cuts, there's another pun for you, that cuts both ways, right, as we're talking about that one. What's that? let me throw this one out there for you. A good leader doesn't change for change's sake, right? Because sometimes just changing, people think that shows vision, that shows leadership. We just notice here in verse 10, their commitment to do the thing they were supposed to do. Chapter 5, in verse 10. While the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover for the 14th of the month, evening on the plains of Jericho. And that's the sentence you would just read over. But I just want you to notice that they didn't abandon the Passover. That seems so mundane, but they did that thing that God had told them to do. They honored. I think the word kept is a powerful word. I think it implies both observing and preserving. So they both went through and did that thing God commanded them to do, and also that made it more likely it would happen again the next time the Passover was supposed to happen. So don't change for change's sake. Do the things that we know while you're examining and being willing to change things you can. Don't change things you can't. And don't chase change. I think leaders that get caught in that kind of vortex, they think the best thing to do is just shake things up. I don't think shaking things up accomplishes anything but confusion and a lack of clarity and direction. When the only constant is change, that doesn't, I don't think, reflect very well on leaders. So they kept the Passover like they were supposed to. And then the final thing I want to talk about, this is from Joshua, preparing for success, right? So it's thinking about, in order to get from where we are to where God wants us to be, I've got to be willing to lead through change. And leading through change is hard, right? You study leadership in a corporate setting, you'll talk about change management and leading through change, transformational leadership. That's the hardest thing to do, is maybe lead people through change. If you think about it from a spiritual sense, that's all we're doing, is leading people through transformation, helping them become who God wants them to be. But it may require the strength and the courage we talked about in the first point, to lead people, to overcome inertia, to avoid the risk of making change for change's sake. Maybe most of your people would like to make this change, but you know it's not best for them. You don't make that change. Leadership does what people need, not necessarily what they want, when the two are in conflict. But then as I think about the portrait here as chapter 5 ends, leading God's people, preparing for success, I think means kneeling, but with a sword in hand. So let's just finish reading verse, or chapter 5, and we'll be done for today. When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "No, I am a commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy ground, is holy." And Joshua did so. So there's a lot of discussion could be had about that, whether it's a theophany or those kind of things. And we can talk about some of that if you want to. But I just want to make these points. First of all, I like it. I think it's one of those little biblical understatements where the language is just very plain. But Joshua looks and sees a dude with a sword, and all we're told is he went to him. Joshua went. The warrior Joshua went and saw a dude with a sword. I guarantee you Joshua had his sword, and Joshua went to him to see who he was, because Joshua was willing to defend the people of God. So Joshua had the courage to pick his sword up, go, "Let me check on this guy with a sword out here." And I think there's something to be said about that. A leader always has to be ready to protect God's people. And I want to suggest to you that my assumption, or my inference from that passage, that's what Joshua was ready to do. Joshua was ready to go see who that was with the sword and what business they had there. What side are you on? And Joshua was willing to stand in the gap individually and take care of that, or to see what was going on there. Let me just suggest to you, leaders have to be that way. In your families, in your homes, you got to be ready to protect those people God's charged you with. And you wouldn't hesitate to protect their physical safety. And most of you, I know you would not hesitate a second to protect the physical safety of your wives and children. Let's have the same attitude about their spiritual welfare. As leaders in your home, be ready to protect your families. If it means unplugging something, canceling a subscription to something, putting somebody else's phone in your pocket for a week or two, whatever you got to do to ending relationships that aren't good influences for your children, for your family, those kind. Leaders have to be ready to protect God's people. It's easy, I think, to see that application in your home, but it's also in the church. So often, elders get accused of being reactive when they're really being proactive. Think about this image with me. If you have a flock of sheep, and you have, say, multiple elders, say three elders, if the best way to protect a flock, would it be for all three elders to have their back, all be facing inward looking at the sheep? Would that be the best way to protect the flock? It'd be best if at least at all times, at least one of the elders was kind of scanning the horizon, wouldn't it? One of the shepherds was watching. When do you want to see the wolf? See how easy the shepherd thing is? You want to see the wolf before he gets in the flock. But I will tell you right now, you're going to be watching for wolves, and your sheep all the time are going to be not happy about that. It's like they want to wait till there's bloodshed and there's a leading lamb there before they think you should say anything about a wolf. But leaders have to be strong and courageous. Listen, we live in an era of, you guys heard the term shrinking globe? The idea that with technology and things, I mean, somebody starts teaching something that's untrue, it's on the internet and it's influencing people in your flock right now. Do you have to wait till that guy shows up before you warn the flock about that false teaching, about those situations? So be ready to protect God's people. You see that here, I think, in Joshua. But not only from external threats, false teaching, but again, bad attitudes, divisiveness, things that cause problems in the flock. So you got to have, shepherds got to be looking both directions, or you got to be rotating, somebody's looking out, somebody's looking in. Both things are important, but you have to be ready to protect God's people, but always seeking God's guidance. And that's, to me, I see this portrait of Joshua walking out, I guess, ready to do either. You know, I've heard the old story about the restoration preacher that showed up in a town to preach and had a Bible, a Constitution, and a pistol. Y'all heard that story? No, he held the Bible up and said, this is for those of you that respect the Word of God. He held the Constitution up and says, this is for those of y'all who expect the rule of law. And then he got the pistol and said, this is for the rest of you, don't respect anything. That was his attitude. It's a joke, really. But the point is, you see, Joshua was ready for either. He walked out there with his sword. If I need to defend God's people, I will. But as soon as he found out who that was, he knelt down. What would you have your servant do? So I think as far as a single image in my mind of a leader among God's people, that's it. Kneeling with sword in hand. Because even the shepherds among God's people have to remember that we're working for the chief shepherd. And that's what's most important. And this, just to finish up, turn over to 1 Peter chapter 5 with me if you would. First Peter chapter 5, so exhort the elders among you as a fellow elder to witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly as God would have you, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. So, I think always keep the words of Peter to his fellow shepherds there in mind. But I hope today serves kind of as a framework to start ways to think about reading the book of Joshua, see what it looks like from the perspective of him ready to be a leader for God's people and dare to be a leader, be willing to arise. Any comments, questions, observations, or scenarios, or anything anybody wants the group to talk about? Any from any other men, Brent?
Just reflecting on what you said about elders being in the position of leading by example, but also having a place for command and delegation. A comment was made about a congregation near us by one of their members, that the elders had a policy that any of the preaching or teaching that happened in the church had to be from the King James Version. And I don't know how they framed it, but this member thought that was unreasonable. And at the time, I'm like, I'm surprised that you know, elders would make a decision like that. But would that be included as part of their trust relationship with their congregation to say, this is, you know, we want consistency in versions or whatever that.
You know, I'm not going to try to answer a local kind of issue. I don't know the reasons that. Yeah, that's a tough thing. I don't know the whys and what fors there. And I appreciate the fact, even in framing the questions, you're trailing off there. You talked about what possibly could be some of the reasons, whether it's standardization or so. I don't know, but You know, elders are human beings, so their judgment is not infallible. And judgment issues obviously are tough to deal with. And so I guess the way I've always kind of leaned, and my whole adult life, not just because I'm serving now, is judgment issues are kind of hard, but usually I can tell whether it's inherently sinful or not. What's a little clearer to me is my responsibility toward the shepherds where I serve. And, you know, I've got a King James at the house. So I might, in a situation like that, maybe it could possibly that I just bring it with me. I don't know, and I'm not saying that's the only right answer, and there shouldn't be some discussions and things like that. But those are always, there's always multiple things to think about, usually in those kind of scenarios and situations, especially if we're not there. Any other thoughts? Yes, sir.
So you've made a lot of applications to shepherds, but I was wondering what thoughts you had about what kind of authority evangelists had. Titus 2:15, these things speak and exhort and reprove with all authority, let no one disregard you. So I think there is a sense in which evangelists have authority, but how does that look?
The simple answer, and I don't mean it to be anything other than this, is that, you know, this is how much authority I think I have as an evangelist and try to convince the people sitting there to follow its teaching and instruction, which is how I understand what Paul was telling Timothy and Titus. And ultimately, that's the level of authority elders have as well. But I think in how that plays out on a practical level, the presence of identified leadership helps maybe deal with situations when folks won't respond to what the Bible says about things. But I think that's a difficult situation. We talk about the pastor model. You know, so often if you're at a place that doesn't have elders, leadership by default starts to fall on the, almost to the point where I think the harder thing is trying not to exert too much power and influence as an evangelist about some things. But that is a difficult kind of balance. But I'm going to stop there and then leave the rest of the time for Marshall.